uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds, right? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet. On RadioPower.org, live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, also podcasting from WhiteRoseSociety.org and archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. On terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, on Sirius Satellite Radio, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital, our telephone number 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. And from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. If you want to drop into our chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Lots in the news today. Howard Dean, Andy Borowitz, here's the Borowitz take on it first, and then I'll share with you my take on it. Borowitz's headline, Dean calls Republicans fat and ugly. Apologizes for omitting insults from recent tirade. Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean apologized today for calling Republicans pretty much a white Christian party, saying that he had failed to mention that they were fat and ugly as well. Dr. Dean offered the clarification at a press conference at the DNC headquarters in Washington, D.C., telling reporters, any characterization of Republicans as white and Christian is unfair since it totally omits the fact that they are pretty much the party of the fat and the ugly, too. Somehow he missed mentioning Jerry Falwell in that. Anyhow, the notoriously outspoken DNC chief immediately drew the ire of leading Republicans who objected to his characterization of Republicans as predominantly white, Christian, fat, and ugly. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, a Republican in Tennessee, lashed out at Dr. Dean from the floor of the Senate, saying anyone who says that Republicans are white, Christian, fat, and ugly is only telling part of the story. Dr. Dean owes an apology to all non-white, non-Christian Republicans who are skinny and attractive. But hours later, Dr. Dean continued to stoke the controversy with his response to Senator Frist's remarks. He says, now I knew I was forgetting something. Republicans are really stupid, too. And Bill Frist, in my opinion, is not even a real doctor. In the aftermath of Dr. Dean's latest remarks, leading Democrats were mulling what to do with their volatile party chief, exploring a range of options, including driving him out of the country and ditching him along a secluded road. Well, see, here's my take on this. I think Howard Dean is spot on. You know, the fact of the matter is that the Republican Party is the party of big business, pure and simple. And, you know, however you want to define that, whatever you need to say about that, and you look at the stats and, the, you know, what, 85%, as I recall, this last number was of registered Republicans were white Christian males, and 57% of registered Democrats were. So now there's all kinds of numbers floating around out there. But who's going to deny that? I think Dean, I applaud Howard Dean for standing up for what he said, and continuing to speak out and continuing to be outrageous. And I want to say to Joe Biden, Joe, get over it. Joe Biden, who I have tremendous respect for, in some regards. I mean, the guy voted for the bankruptcy bill, so we know that Joe can be bought. But nonetheless, I think, particularly in terms of foreign policy, Joe Biden is a really smart guy and has a lot of very important things to say to all of us. But nonetheless, you know, come on, Joe. Picking on Howard Dean, oh, he doesn't speak for me. Come on, it's time for the Democrats to say, yes, we can be a little outrageous. We can be a lot outrageous. I mean, look, you've got Republicans running around going, saying, you know, Bill Clinton killed Vince Foster. I mean, consider some of the things that have been said by Republicans about Democrats. And then Howard Dean, I mean, he's Casper Milquetoast. Come on. Get a spine, Democrats. And stop eating your own. This is tragic. This is really sad. And David Sirota had a great piece, which I thought I had in my stack here, but I don't see it, about how historically the Republicans actually have won on being the angry party. And, you know, and Democrats are being told, don't be so angry. Oh, please, Dr. Dean, don't be so angry. Governor Dean, no, don't be angry. Come on, the Republicans, they went on this rant about taxes. We're angry about taxes. Yeah, and they got people all upset about that. And there's a whole series of things there that, David Sirota had come up with. And it's just the Republicans need to get their act together. I mean, the Democrats need to get their act together. It's and frankly, I think, you know, you've hired this guy as your leader. Follow him. Or at least participate with him. Frankly, I think what we're seeing here, really, I mean, when you get right down to it, really what I think we're seeing is that there is a schism in the Democratic Party, just as real as the schism in the Republican Party. The schism in the Republican Party is the schism between the corporatists, the people who really have the power, the people who are saying, hey, what we're all about, what the Republicans are all about is multinational corporations and money. And inherited wealth. And it's really the party of, by, and for people who have net assets worth, you know, in excess of $10 or $20 million. Clearly, those in excess of $100 million, good Republicans. Yeah, people think, you know, they're making $100,000, $200,000 a year. They think they're rich. Come on. Give me a break. The Republicans are not interested in people making $100,000, $200,000 a year. I mean, they'll exploit them the same way they exploit Christians. They'll, you know, here, we'll throw you a bone. But the fact of the matter is that somebody making more than $10 million a year is paying less in taxes than somebody making $150,000 a year. It's just, you know, simple fact. What the Republicans are very much, you know, and so anyhow, you've got this one faction in the Republican Party, which is the faction of wealth and power, inherited wealth, you know, the Richard Mellon Scaife faction. Funding the Heritage Foundation and whatnot. Inherited wealth, the Walton families leading the charge, donating massive amounts of money to the Republicans to stop the inheritance tax. You got that faction, and then you've got the faction, or factions, I should say. Well, faction, the religious faction that thinks they have power in the Republican Party. Because Pat Robertson said, you know, we're going to take over this party, we're going to do this stuff, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. They think they have power in the Republican Party. And Bill Frist is making an incredible strategic blunder by sucking up to them, I'll tell you. Because they don't have the power. And you know, with Frist, I don't get it. Because he has to know this. I mean, his father is one of the richest men in America. He's a billionaire. Made his money by privatizing hospitals and squeezing the blood out of all the rest of us. They paid over $1 billion just in fines for crimes they committed against you and me by defrauding Medicare, the Frist family fortune, the Frist family business. So, you know, why Bill Frist thinks that he needs to be sucking up to these Tony Perkins, the KKK guy. Tony Perkins' focus on the family who gave, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars to David Duke. I don't get it. But in any case, you got these two factions in the Republican Party, and they're starting to discover that their interests don't always correspond. And, you know, some of the... ideally, for example, with the judges, ideally they find a judge who is anti-abortion, you know, like David Pryor. He says, Roe v. Wade is the worst decision, you know, in history. It was an abomination. It was terrible, bloody... He's somebody who has the right Christian. It's not even, I can't call these guys Christians because I consider myself a Christian, and I don't believe that Jesus would be about politics, frankly. He certainly wasn't when he was on this earth. You know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. But in any case, the Taliban in America, the Christian Taliban in America, I don't know what else to call them. I really don't mean this dismissively. I mean, the unfortunate tragedy is that there are so many good people who have been sucked into this. And I say that as somebody who, you know, in my life, I've for some time attended an Assemblies of God church, you know, a Pentecostal church, participated in that, saw it. You know, there's good people there, and they are being played like fish on a line. By the folks who really have economic interests. And very often they can find somebody like William Pryor. I said David before. Like William Pryor. This Judge Pryor. who have the positions that cause the fundamentalists, the religious fundamentalists, to think that they're on their side, and they are, and also have the economic positions. Janice Rogers Brown, she said, you know, 1937 was the peak of our socialist revolution. Well, what was our socialist revolution that she's so upset about? Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, child labor laws. Our socialist revolution. Janice Rogers Brown wants to undo. So she's been now appointed to the First Circuit, Washington, D.C., the circuit court from which three of our members of our current Supreme Court came. It's the main court from which members of the Supreme Court are drawn. And it's also the court that decides things that have to do with national issues. You know, worker safety, health and welfare, whether or not minimum wage laws are actually, you know, legal and constitutional, all that stuff, if it has to do with Washington, D.C., it goes through the First Circuit. That's the Washington, D.C. court. I mean, putting her there, boy, talk about Fox in the hen house. Well, back to the news. The Wall Street Journal today doing the heavy lifting for the Bush administration, at least in their headlines. Now, they have a graph on this piece, a graphic which points out, you know, pulls back the curtain and says, you know, look at the man behind the curtain. And the graphic shows that revenue is going to be flat from now until 2050, but spending is going to explode based on the Bush budget. But the headline is a suck up to Bush headline. The deficit is arriving under forecasts. Yeah, right. You know, the deficit, everything is wonderful. The deficit is coming in under forecast. Well, it depends on whose forecast you're talking about. See, the White House is claiming all is well because they had forecasted a deficit of $427 billion. Now, they've done this every year of the Bush administration. They forecast miserable numbers, and then when just slightly less than miserable numbers come in, they go, hey, look at that. Things are getting better. But things aren't getting better. The Bush administration, the budget deficit, which should be zero, it should be a surplus. We should be paying off our national debt. The budget deficit looks like it's going to be about $350 billion, and the Bush administration is crowing about it. Well, Morgan Stanley had projected that it was going to be $335 billion. The ISI group had projected $350 billion. This from the Wall Street Journal. Goldman Sachs had predicted $370 billion. The Congressional Budget Office had predicted $350 billion. Only the Bushies had predicted $427 billion. But even at that, Jackie Combs in the Wall Street Journal, the White House hasn't had much good news since President Bush's second term began, but it's about to start spreading some. Yes, he is spreading. This year's deficit came in lower than anticipated. Right. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Welcome back. It is 25 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. David in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Look, I agree with you entirely about Howard Dean. I say let Howard speak. I mean, I worked on his campaign. I have a lot of respect for the man. But my point is, I believe that the timing is right. The right person can lead at the right time. And I was really struck by Dennis Kucinich on your program the other day. Mm-hmm. The clarity that he showed was just incredible. And I think that if we have an angry but poised and balanced leader, there's going to be, and there is, a backlash that is being created right now. And someone like Kucinich, and there are few like him, his energy can be contagious at the right time. And I think the right time is now. I think the country needs to get behind a Dennis Kucinich. And I believe that we may be ready for a leader of this magnitude. You know?
Well,
that's all.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot, David. I appreciate it. I have no doubt that Dennis Kucinich is going to be back around, you know, running for president. I shouldn't say I have no doubt, but I would be surprised if he didn't. And I think that the fact that he's now campaigning around the United States or you know, speaking around the United States speaks to that. And I don't mean it in a cynical way. He's building a base. He's building a constituency. And there are folks out there who receive him very well. He spoke here in Portland, Oregon, and there were, I don't know, several hundred people. He and I both spoke at the Unitarian Church here last weekend and last Sunday. And it was, you know, it was full. I mean, a lot of people showed up to hear his message. So, yeah, maybe his day will come. We'll see. Hopefully. Kenny in Baltimore on the line. Hey, Kenny, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on, man? How are you doing?
Good. What's up?
I just want to say I support Dean a whole lot with this. I didn't know too much about, you know, Dean and his character before the election, but, you know, since then I've been learning a whole lot about him.
Yeah.
I think a lot of Democrats, these Democrats forgot who they're supposed to be representing, and I don't believe Dean hasn't. You know, they can't get on him about this fundraising and stuff. He's never going to be able to equal the Republicans on fundraising. He represents the poor and middle class.
Yeah.
That's being squeezed right now. So,
well, that's the thing. I mean, you know,
get his knowledge.
What the Democratic Party was doing under Bill Clinton and Terry McAuliffe was they were going to big corporations and saying, okay, we'll go along with you on the bankruptcy bill. We'll go along with you on pollution. We'll go along with you on the drug company stuff. And give us money, please. And Howard Dean came in saying, hey, you know, we don't have to do that. We can go right to the people. We can use the Internet to do it. And he hasn't been quite as successful, I think, frankly, because, you know, people are not as engaged right now. People think that politics is a sport that you only play right around elections. And so, you know, there's not an election happening right at this minute. But I have a feeling that he will be very successful over the course of the next year and a half as we come into the 2006 elections. And he is having actually some considerable success compared to nothing. I mean, you know, but your point is well taken. And,
yeah.
And if we're going to move the Democratic Party in the direction of being more populist and less corporatist, move it away from the direction that Bill Clinton had been moving it, then I think we need Howard Dean and we need to be doing this. And one of the things that concerns me is that there may be a Clinton faction, a Bill Clinton faction. I still don't know where Hillary Clinton is at on this, although I suspect she's kind of following in the footsteps of Bill. Or maybe he was following in hers, I don't know. But in any case, I think we need to move the Democratic Party away from the idea, the DLC idea, that the only way to win elections is to get into bed with multinational corporations and to sign things like the Telecommunications Act and NAFTA and GATT and the things that Bill Clinton thought that he had to do in order to keep his economic base, and instead go back and say to the working people of America, as Franklin Roosevelt did, I'm on your side. I'm with you. We're going to work this out. We're going to make this happen together and bring back America, bring the working people of America that way back and bring back the Democratic Party that way. And I think Howard Dean can do that.
I believe he can, too. You know, I own a small business, and I'm feeling the pinch like everybody else and everything.
Yeah.
And all I'm looking for is just somebody to say, look, we hear you, and we're going to do it not with just our mouth. We're going to do it with our action. I mean, hey.
There you go. You're absolutely right, Kenny. Absolutely right. We've got to get behind Howard Dean, in my opinion, and let the Democrats know, hey, we're fine with an angry Democratic Party leader, even though I don't think he's angry, but outspoken, let's say. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
They seek him here. They seek him there.
And here he is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 27 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website, if you want to drop into the chat room for some of the finest, most intelligent, thoughtful, thought-provoking. And this morning they were discussing, what do you call it, swing clubs? Strange conversation. Actually, I think it had to do with John Bolton. Strange conversation on the entire Internet. It's a really good. Actually, we had a troll in there for a little while. I guess that qualifies as strange. That's always entertaining when the trolls come to visit. But this whole point that that the Democrats shouldn't be angry, right? They shouldn't be outspoken. I mean, think about how the Republicans, starting with Ronald Reagan, have succeeded at Reagan and Gingrich. They railed against bad government, right? Government is bad. Ronald Reagan, government is not the solution. Government is the problem, right? Well, tell that to somebody who was just rescued by a firefighter.
Oh, government, that's your problem.
Excuse me, the government just saved me from a burning building. Yes, I will acknowledge there are some things government does very poorly and does not do well, and right now the government is in the hands of maniacs, and that can be very dangerous for things like civil liberties. But nonetheless, the Republicans campaigned on an anti-government platform. In fact, Ronald Reagan ran for re-election against himself and won. That's how strong their anti-pessimism, negative campaign was. You're being ripped off by taxes, to quote David Sirota, quoting the Republicans. Anger about taxes. Anger about gays. I mean, here you've got, in I believe it was 11 states, where it was already illegal to have gay marriage because of the Defense of Marriage Act or other laws in those states. In 11 states, the Republicans put on constitutional amendments or laws to forbid gay marriage. Why? Not because they wanted to stop gay marriage, but because they wanted to win an election by pandering to people's fears and by being negative. Why? Because it works. Beat up immigrants. Beat up liberals. I mean, these guys, 15 years, they've been turning the L word into a profanity. Oh, but Joe Biden telling Howard Dean, we shouldn't speak out negatively against our Republican friends because then people will think that we're angry or they'll think that we're negative. And then the Republicans come out and, we don't share your values, you're the other. I mean, as Sirota points out, Newt Gingrich's contract with America was all about pessimism, anger, and divisiveness. And in fact, actually, if you go back and you read the contract on America, or he called it Contract with America, Newt Gingrich's deal, and you actually read it, it proposed 10 pieces of legislation. And if you click through, if you can actually find an original copy of, they're out there on the web, and click through to the original pieces of legislation, 6 out of those 10 pieces of legislation were nothing more than tax cuts. Tax cuts for the wealthy. That's what they all boiled down to. That was the contract on America. And now a lot of it has passed. I mean, you know, Thomas Frank, he wrote a book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Why do people vote against their own economic... They vote for Republicans who then screw them. And they do it over and over again. Why? Because the Republicans get them all whipped up. Thomas Frank calls it backlash conservatism. I think it's time for the Democrats to have a little backlash. I agree with David Sirota when he says the idea that voters are inherently turned off by any form of populism because it might be construed as anger is a very, very poor argument from very, very out-of-touch people who either haven't talked to average working stiffs at the local diner or haven't spent much time thinking about what's happened over the last 20 to 30 years in this country. Right on, David. So, I will go along with that. And that said...
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay, rescued by the right. This is still the Death Watch. It's still going on. It's just stretching out. The Washington Post reports that the House Ethics Committee has shut down for the second time this year, thanks to a conflict over staff hiring initiated by ethics chairman and former Abramoff associate Representative Doc Hastings, Republican of Washington. Now the Washington Post reports it could be months and perhaps next year before the panel investigates the activities of DeLay or others accused of violating ethics restrictions. News of the setback broke last night just as DeLay was enjoying a high-dollar wine and cigar fundraiser with his political action committee. Yes, and at the same time, Tom DeLay has hired a second lawyer, and there's starting to be some pressure on Doc, good old Doc Hastings, to resign. Turns out, from his chairmanship of the House Ethics Committee, he was replaced, of course, by Tom DeLay, because Tom DeLay didn't like the former chairman, who was actually interested in ethics. But it turns out that Hastings was taking money from the same law firm that Jack Abramoff's client, Preston Gates and Ellis, the same lobbying firm that Tom DeLay was. The New York Times just revealed this yesterday. This was this whole thing that DeLay and Abramoff did in the 1990s, a scheme to help the Marianas Islands avoid U.S. labor laws. These are in a U.S. protectorate. The Marianas Islands run brutal sweatshops where workers are paid barely half the U.S. minimum hourly wage, are forced to live behind barbed wire in squalid shacks minus plumbing, and report having been forced into prostitution. And Tom DeLay went over to make sure that it stayed that way. He said the workers there are very happy. And Doc Hastings has received money from this firm over the last 10 years. And just after he met with the folks at Preston Gates, by the way, Bill Gates, one of the founders of that lobbying firm, Preston Gates and Ellis, just after he met with some of the folks at Preston Gates, Doc Hastings stood up on the floor of the House of Representatives denouncing stricter labor laws for the Marianas Islands. His hometown newspaper, or home state newspaper, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, calling on him to step back and turn the DeLay investigation over to a congressionally appointed special prosecutor. Yeah, sounds like a plan to me. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick comment that from what I can see, that the primary or the most important anti-progressive, anti-democratic force out there is the big corporate media. And just a quick example, the Howard Dean brouhaha, which doesn't seem like much to me, has gotten far more airtime than the Downing Street memo.
Right, and the Downing Street memo involves the death of almost 1,700 Americans, the 20,000 lost legs, arms, eyes. You know, we have no idea how many have been mentally wounded, and 100,000 Iraqis dead, according to the Lancet in Great Britain. And that involved lying of an epic scale. It's got virtually no press coverage, and every newspaper in the country, all the media, they're all leading with Howard Dean puts his foot in his mouth. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well said. This is outrageous. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Tony in Santa Ana, California on the line. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to say I love Howard Dean's comments. I think it's great. I think Democrats need to start mixing up the pot a little bit. You know, it's to quote America's favorite therapist, Dr. Phil, you know, hey, Democrats, how's it been working for you?
There you go.
What we've been doing hasn't been working. And so, I mean, you probably get more calls in support of Howard Dean than against him. And I think Joe Biden and Joe Lieberman need to leave the party.
Well, you know, I would suggest that, Tony, that you and that other listeners who feel that way call Joe Biden and tell him. And just tell him that, hey, we support Howard Dean. And you can call him for free. It's a toll-free call, 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the seriously, that's the toll-free number for Capitol Hill.
Right.
Yep,
yeah.
Go for it. Tony, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Yep, 1-877. This is the toll-free number for Congress. It's a nice coincidence. It's actually the old Senate Office Building phone number. And it's a Senate Office Building, the United States Senate Office Building. But it's easy to remember, 1-877-SOB-USOB. And just dial that number and say, I'd like to speak with Joe Biden's office. And then say, Joe Biden, it's unlikely you'll get him on the phone, but you'll get somebody, you'll get a human being, and they will take a message and just say, you know, lay off Howard Dean. We support Howard Dean. We like Howard Dean. We want somebody to stand up to the Republicans. You know, participate in the Democratic Party, Joe. And the same for Joe Lieberman. You can also call 1-877-SOB-USOB to reach Joe Lieberman's office. You just redial it over and over again and just take members of Congress one at a time if you want. It certainly works for the Republicans. This here's a story I started out talking about how the deficit is arriving under the forecasts of the administration. The administration saying, the forecast, the deficit is quite. You know, the deficit is going to be 427. Oh, gee, it's only going to be 350. I guess things are wonderful. Well, you know, and John Snow is going to take this, our Treasury Secretary, he's going to take this thing to the G8 meeting in Scotland and lay this out and say, isn't this great? Because they've been giving us a hard time about our debt and our foreign borrowing. And they're going to say, come on, we can read the Wall Street Journal. We know that everybody in the United States, Morgan Stanley, ISI Group, Goldman Sachs, and the Congressional Budget Office, they were all predicting a deficit of somewhere between $335 and $370 billion. And you came in at $350. And we know that the White House Office of Management and Budget predicted $427. We're not buying it. We know that this is all fluff and PR. We know that you're just, you know, this is for domestic consumption. And I guarantee you, it'll probably be a small story on page 6 in the Wall Street Journal, but I guarantee you, when Snow comes back, or while Snow is over there, the coverage from the G8 meeting is going to be that the G8 countries are saying, America, stop it with the voodoo economics already. Reagan nearly destroyed the country doing this, and Greenspan had to, and Dan Moynihan had to get together and raise the Social Security tax on working people so that there would be enough money in the Social Security Trust Fund that the federal government could borrow that money so it could continue operating for the next 20 years on borrowed money, borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund, just to deal with the insane deficits that Ronald Reagan created. And, you know, most Americans are completely blissfully unaware of this, that there is actually some truth to what George W. Bush said when he said, I've seen those pieces of paper, they're worthless IOUs, and they're treasury bills. They're actually a special form of treasury bill. It's like intergovernment. So it's not quite the same treasury bills that are sold to China or sold to you or me if, you know, if one of us had the money to buy one. And the reality is that in order for Social Security to start paying off its obligations out of the Social Security Trust Fund, the federal government is going to have to start paying that money back to the Social Security Trust Fund, $1.5 trillion. And the federal government doesn't have that money. Why doesn't it have that money? Because of Bush's tax cuts for billionaires and multimillionaires. It's pretty straightforward. So anyhow, here's this story. Two former America West pilots were convicted Wednesday of being drunk in the cockpit the morning after an all-night drinking binge in a sports bar. Thomas Cloyd, 47, Christopher Hughes, 44, arrested July 1st, 2002, as their Phoenix-bound jet was being pushed back from its gate at Miami International Airport. The pilots had 14 beers between them the night before the flight, closing out their $122 bar tab at 4:40 a.m., 6 hours before their flight was to depart. Hours later, they registered blood alcohol levels above Florida's 0.08 legal limit. Now, what does this have to do with the trade deficit and voodoo economics, Bushonomics, Reaganomics? What it has to do with it is that now what we're seeing is, right across the board, what we're seeing is the evisceration, the wiping out of the middle class of America and the foundations of the middle class, and what used to be, you know, serious career kinds of jobs, like being a pilot, are now, you know, maybe I can get by kind of jobs. These small commuter airlines are paying about the same as a manager at a McDonald's. I mean, some of these pilots are being paid $15,000, $20,000 a year. And so what are you getting? You're getting folks who have 14 beers between them. So, after all, I mean, it's not a career. It's something I learned how to do in the Air Force. I can fly airplanes or something like that. It's just, you know, I remember when Michael Moore in his stupid white man book, you know, on the back cover, he made the joke about, you know, do you want the guy flying your airplane to be earning less money than the guy who says, do you want fries with that at Wendy's? And here we are. This is the new economy. This is the new world order that George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr., talked about. The new world order, It's called feudalism. We have come back to an ancient form of governance. It was called feudalism then. In the late 1920s, Benito Mussolini reinvented it. He called it fascism. Back in the feudal days, the feudal lords, it was based on land ownership providing power and wealth. And in Mussolini's, it was corporate ownership providing power and wealth. But it was a way to provide a stable society. I mean, you have to acknowledge that the conservative worldview has, you know, a good intention. Let's create a stable society. The problem is it doesn't have room for democracy in it. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Harpin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Larry in Bristol, Rhode Island on the line. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Good, what's up?
Good. I was just calling because I wanted to mention the word tariff in light of the subjects you've been talking about and the economic situation.
Oh, this is the solution. We just need to go back to tariffs. I mean, it's not rocket science. It worked for over 200 years in this country. It built an industrial infrastructure. It built a great nation. But these guys are just—they're so disconnected from reality.
Somebody was talking. Maybe it was on your show. A labor guy finally mentioned this word that. You know, we were taught, and I was taught, I mean, I'm 57, I was taught that, you know, free market, Smoot-Hawley tariff, and that's what brings on the depression, all that, which I think is not true, but I think there was an article recently in Harper's reviewing a book, and he pointed out that when England, you know, went free trade, it destroys them. It destroys
the big
country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's destroying us as well. Larry, thanks a lot for raising that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And absolutely, and Smoot-Hawley did not prolong or deepen the Great Depression. And Smoot-Hawley, by the way, was something that Herbert Hoover pushed through in 1930, 2 years before Roosevelt came along. And all it was an increase in our tariffs to try and strengthen our domestic industries. Brian in Houston on the line. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Tom. I agree with what you're saying on the issue of the wages being suppressed and going down. And I see it every day. I see people doing work and making a lot less than they used to make for the same type of thing. But where do we go from here? I mean, I think the Republicans have fixed it in such a way that the deficit is so high that if any Democrat gets in there now, we've got to raise some taxes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole starve the beast strategy, and they laid it out. I mean, they were quite public about it. They were going to drive us into such a terrible deficit that no Democrat could ever again have a social program, that we'd have to raise taxes just to get us back to zero, and therefore Social Security is toast, Medicare is toast, you know, long term, down the road, you know, any kind of welfare programs, any kind of floor for the folks, public education. You want to have scholarships for college, for middle class people to send their kids to college, forget it. You know, public education, we're going to take it apart. This is their program, and they're quite a ways down the road on it. But I don't think that they're so far down the road on it that we can't stop them so far right now, Brian. If we can infiltrate the Democratic Party, give them a spine, and take back the House and or the Senate in 2006, then I think that there's a very real possibility we could turn this thing around. And that's what we all have to be focused on. We have to think of politics as a 365-day-a-year sport or game or whatever. It's far more than either one, really, because it involves our lives and the lives of many, many other people. Brian, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And thanks, everybody, who's called in today. We'll be back. It's Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, every Thursday, the second hour of our program, we explore what you didn't know you didn't know. You know, there are those things you know that you know, and there are the things that you don't know that you don't know, but there are also things that you don't know that you don't know that you, maybe you need to know, but you don't even know that you need to know them because you don't know them. And sometimes the things that you do know are not the things that you thought that you knew, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong, you know?
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Rick Goodner is a licensed clinical social worker in Texas. And a bit of an observer of George W. Bush and our media. He's written a book called The Fox Syndrome, Right-Wing Media Induced Shared Psychotic Disorder, ISPD, Rick?
Hey.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, got you there.
Yeah, welcome to the program.
I know why you got me here. You wanted to hear what a real Texas accent sounds like after listening to Bush for 6 years.
Well, yeah. George, actually, he was born in Connecticut. He grew up on the East Coast. He went to prep school on the East Coast. He went to college on the East Coast. He summered in Kennebunkport. How did he get to be a Texan? I never understood that.
Well, he came down and he bought a hunk of land, didn't put any cattle on it, and started wearing boots and just declared himself to be a Texan.
But when did he start talking with a Texas accent?
Well, that's not a Texas accent. That's probably one of the worst fake accents I've ever heard in my life. He started that when he was going for national. He made up his mind that he would be president. At the same time, he took his Stetson over to Palestine, and he wanted to meet with a gentleman there.
Palestine, Texas, you're talking about?
No, Palestine over in Israel.
Oh, Palestine, okay.
Yeah, he tried to meet with the Palestinian leader, and the Palestinian leader left him standing outside his door with his Stetson in his hand, and that is the reason why he refused to meet with the Palestine leader, Yasser Arafat.
Oh, interesting, because Arafat refused to meet with him?
Uh-huh. How narcissistic is that?
yeah, remarkable.
I will never talk to this guy now.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. So, when George Bush was governor of Texas, did he have a Texas accent?
He had one, but we could all pick it up immediately. We have a lot of biscuits running around here.
It's really just a bad Southern accent, then.
It's a bad fake Southern accent. Most people can pick it up if they've been down this way.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I know I've in some of his speeches, I've heard him give presentations where he's talking to, for example, his Have and the Have More speech, you know, where he's talking to a group of wealthy donors. There's no mm-hmm. Texas accent there. He's talking East Coast accent.
East Coast.
Yeah, and that's but that's not what I wanted to get you on to talk about. I'm curious about your, I have your book here in front of me, and in fact I've spent some time with it, and I find it fascinating that you're suggesting that there is a collective mental illness spreading across the United States, or shall we say it's infectious and it's being spread across the United States. I thought in particular your chapter on Sean Hannity was fascinating, taking apart his book piece by piece and then your comments to him about Bambi and whatnot. But in any case, that this induced shared psychotic disorder that is being induced by Fox Media and whatnot. Tell us about this. How'd you come to this conclusion as a licensed clinical social worker?
Let's take a first, take just a small look at a couple of things. You would take something like the Branch Davidians. Now, they had fairly normal people in there, and then you had one person, bipolar, with psychotic features, Caress, who was running it.
Right.
How was he able to talk these people into turning over their daughters, their sons, and their wives to him and to service him? How was he able to get people to say, the building's burning down, but we're going to stay in here, we're not going to run out, we're going to go ahead and die here? We know that he was psychotic. How was he able to get these normal people to do it?
Well, and people ask the same question about Jim Jones and arguably about, the Pope that led the Crusades. And, right. you could go back through history and find a whole bunch of examples. Alexander the Great, some asked that question of.
Absolutely. And then Jim Jones' case, most people don't realize that most of the people that were following him were court-ordered to do so.
Yeah.
It was a religious initiative.
Yeah, it was one of the early faith-based programs.
It was
a court-ordered diversion. Yeah.
But any time that you're living in a situation where you hear one side of a story, from a delusional person. To survive, you have to start picking up the delusion. You have to get into somebody else's delusion, or you're going to go completely crazy, or you're going to run away. And a lot of people do run away.
So are you suggesting that, and I need you to speak just a little bit louder, Rick. I've got the gain all the way up here, and it's not quite popping the needle. Are you suggesting that the right-wing media in America and that, the right-wing talk media, by and large, Fox News, and that the Bushies, the Bush administration and whatnot, that these, and then the neocons, this whole bunch of them, that they are actually deluded, or could it be that they are simply lying to us?
There's the rub. Now, what we know for sure about them is that except for Sean Hannity, they all have advanced degrees. So we have to assume they're not completely stupid. Okay. Except...
But stupid doesn't mean not insane.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There are some brilliant people who are nuts.
Right, absolutely. And then every one of them, whenever your fine show, Bob Kincaid, Air America, when y'all point out the inconsistencies, no, let's just say what it is, when y'all point out the lies, they jump back and holler, oh, no, we're not lying. So we can assume they're not stupid. We have to accept their word when they're saying they're not lying. There is only one other option.
They're deluded.
If they do honestly believe in what they're saying, it is a delusion. I have never been able to find not one thing that has supported the possibility that Goebbels did not believe everything he was saying.
Yeah.
The propaganda ministry, most people just say that he was an evil propagandist, but I haven't found anything that shows that he didn't believe it. And I'm not for sure that these people don't believe it. We know from Rush Limbaugh's declaration that he is addicted to OxyContin, taking up to 300 pills a month. You know, one pill would knock me out for 2 days.
Sure.
That as it may.
But that doesn't make him crazy. I mean, that just makes him a drug addict, and that's a fairly common thing in America.
Ah, but there is a mental illness that goes along with that called... opiate-induced psychosis.
Okay.
Really
well, you know, but aren't we reaching, I mean, for example, here's George Bush. The majority of Americans who support Bush, well over 70% of them, believe that there was a connection between Iraq, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and 9/11, right? They believe that. And, you know, you could say that that's a shared delusion. Now, the question is, does George Bush share that delusion? Because he tries to reinforce it every time he gives a speech. He will talk about Iraq, and he'll talk about 9/11. Iraq, 9/11. Iraq, 9/11. But when he's asked the direct question, here's his response.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th. No.
We have no evidence, no, he says. So he's not deluded about that.
So that would make him a liar.
Okay.
But then again, you do have the other... parts, like when he was in Israel and he made the statement that God ordered him to attack Iraq.
Well, maybe he believes that. But are you suggesting that somebody who believes that God talks to them is deluded?
If there is no fact of God actually talking, if the voice did not actually boom down from heaven,
yeah.
In my cases that I've worked with, those people are usually psychotic. Now, I'm not saying that he's psychotic. I don't know. I've never talked to the man personally.
Yeah.
But if he honestly believes that he heard God's voice and God's voice did not come down to him and tell him to do this, then that would be a psychosis.
Yeah, I suspect that it was more a phrase of speech, that mm-hmm. that what he was trying to say is that he thinks that he's doing God's will on earth.
So we hope so.
I mean, I think, I frankly think most people, you know, deep down in their hearts, hope that they're doing God's will on earth, or doing the right thing, or however they would phrase it. I mean, that's just his epistemology, his worldview, that he would phrase that. But are you suggesting, Rick Goodner, a licensed clinical social worker, the author of The Fox Syndrome, Right-Wing Media-Induced Shared Psychotic Disorder, that there is a psychotic disorder that, well, actually, just back to George Bush. Here's another Bush. I'd just love to hear your take on this.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Can you make sense out of that?
I couldn't hear it very well, but it sounds like you said we're really talking about peace.
Yeah, well, here it is again.
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
No, there's not much sense in that. War and peace are completely opposite. I can't see how you're talking peace and war at the same time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there are those who would say World War II brought about peace.
Yes, yes. So, but not for the people that were getting bombed and everything.
Yeah.
But, be, you know, as it may.
Okay.
He
well,
may
back,
really
back,
be convinced that he is fighting the Great Crusade to bring peace to the world.
Yeah. So back to my question, do you think that there is actually, I mean, a lot of this book seems to be kind of lighthearted. There's, you know, some kind of funny parts to it, but there's also a lot of serious facts in here, and you really take apart a lot of these, a lot of the folks on the right, and they're either, you know, depending on your perspective, either their lies or their delusions. Do you really think that there is a psychotic disorder among the American people, or do you think that they're simply convinced of things that aren't true?
Going back to the people of the Branch Davidian, every part of their life was normal, except their belief that they were the seed of David, and they were going to go straight up to heaven. The gentleman who castrated themselves and then took the poison to jump into the tail of the comet and get into the spaceship, don't you think they probably really believed that they were going to go up there?
Yeah.
It's delusion.
Yeah.
What happens with a delusion is very simple.
So,
I got it,
yeah, what's the difference between a delusion and a belief in something that just isn't so?
Just isn't so. Well, okay. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, fourth edition,
right.
Which is our Bible for working through any mental disorders. It's had 100 years of testing. It is...
I'm familiar with it.
Yes, it is it. Rates it as this. A delusion develops in an individual in contact with a relationship with another person who has an already established delusion. If these talk show people, if Fox really believes in what they're saying, then it is a delusion. If they don't, then we need to call them on being a lie. They need to either fess up to being liars or they need to fess up to being delusional. It's one of the two.
Yeah.
Second part, B, delusion is similar in context to the person who has the already established delusions. We have heard the mantras over and over and over from people who listen to these things and bring out the very same words. Oh, Fox, it's fair and balanced. They just tell me and I decide, that kind of stuff.
Right.
See,
Rick, we're out of time here, but I get the point. It seems that there's a little bit of a blurring here. You can go either direction on this, but fascinating. The Fox Syndrome, Right-Wing Media, Induced Shared Psychotic Disorder by Rick Goodner, licensed clinical social worker. Rick, is there real quickly a website for this book?
My publisher is Amazon, so take a guess who sells my book.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Thanks a lot, Rick. Good to have you on, and nice to hear a real Texas accent for a change.
Appreciate it, sir.
Have a great day now. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane.
I'd like to know that, George.
Without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run.
George, I hope you're having fun.
George, I hope you're having fun.
And welcome back. That from Jim Turr at BlueCanyonSatire.com. Welcome back to the program. Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones with us with our daily report from Washington, D.C., from the belly of the beast with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen and Victoria.
Well, it's Ellen, and then you'll talk to Victoria. We're actually driving to the new media seminar in the car. So
oh, great.
Kind of got both of us next to each other.
I will see you there on Saturday.
That's right. So let's see what we're focusing on. We're focusing on the fact that the White House is trying to tell us that the economy is great, that it has, yesterday it had a press conference on a phone with us reporters about these kinds of things, and today Greenspan is saying that it's in reasonably good shape. Now, as you know, Greenspan, as we call him, Greenspan for hire in Washington, because in order to keep his job, he's about willing to say anything and do anything.
Right.
The other thing is, of course, and I'm going to have put Victoria on the line to talk about the some of the fallout from this tobacco issue. We do know that the Democrats are seizing upon this issue to talk about the fact that the Justice Department absolutely is moving away from any significant fines for the tobacco industry. And I'm going to let Victoria talk to you about some of the fallout in Washington.
Okay, this the fallout of the Justice Department becoming basically the political arm or the fulfilling of promises arm of the Republican National Committee.
Yes, apparently so. Even to the surprise of the tobacco companies, apparently, Philip Morris was expressing surprise that they had reduced their request from $130 billion to $10 billion for an anti-smoking campaign. Nobody expected this, including the judge. I don't know if we're going to have hearings on this. It wouldn't surprise me. Frankly, the whole of Washington is surprised by this, because this is the same Justice Department that tried to drop the lawsuit and only continued it because of public outrage. So, you know, apparently, so fascinating. You can't smoke dope to be out of pain, but they sure as heck want to keep you puffing those cancer sticks.
Yeah, and generating the profit for them, because that profit is going to the Republican Party.
So why don't they do the same thing with marijuana?
Well, they would have to decriminalize it first. I mean, see, here's the answer, the quick answer. One of the fastest growing industries in the United States, outside of military construction, the fastest growing construction industry in the United States is private prisons. And as long as pot is illegal, we have in the United States more people in prison than any other country in the world, both per capita and absolute numbers. And it's a growth industry.
Fascinating.
A lot of money to be made there, and they've got a lot of lobbyists on Capitol Hill, and they're walking around knocking on a lot of doors. So it's going to be a long time before anything gets decriminalized, in my opinion, in Washington, D.C. So what else are you finding in Washington? What's going on in Washington today?
Certainly there's fallout from that. Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security Secretary, is testifying on Capitol Hill, which is always going to be fascinating, because he's going to be talking, he's going to be having to defend the Patriot Act in some way, shape, or other, although, frankly, Congress is going to have to defend it, seeing as they seem to be more than happy to be giving more power. The White House is apparently, putting out talking points, Ellen, about the Patriot Act?
That's right.
So, yeah.
Goodbye, Fourth Amendment.
Yeah,
the beat goes on. Goodbye, Fourth Amendment. It is a tragedy. Thank you so much, Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Always a pleasure to have you on with your reports from Washington, D.C., and in this case, Washington en route to New York. Great to have you here. Thank you so much. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Tell me you love facts real straight.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Talk radio for the rest of us. Frank in Phoenix on the line. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Tom, how's it going?
Good.
You know what? I get tired of hearing all these Republicans talk about FDR and blaming him for taking money out of their pocket and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I took my paycheck and I looked at my paycheck and on each term, you know, FIC and all of that, I put into Google. So I looked at where these all got started.
Right.
Well, on income tax, when that came up, it was very interesting. You know how, like, Republicans complain about taxes and, you know, the government's taking money out of you and all of this. Well, when you look up income tax, you know, it goes back in history. And about 25 years before FDR, there was this bill that got passed by a president, and it had to do with income tax. I don't know how they got this to pass by the people. He must have went up to them and said, we're going to allow you to work, and all of this, and we're going to take money out of your check each week.
Yeah, what's the punchline here, Frank?
There is no punchline. That president just so happened to be President Taft, and he so happened to be a Republican.
Right, from Ohio. Yeah, okay, so that's the punchline. Okay.
So how are these people, you know, blaming the Democrats for income tax coming out when their party is the one that started it all?
Well, you know, it's...
I know the government used to be run off of tariffs and all that, you know, before taxes.
Yeah, by and large. I mean, Lincoln raised some taxes to fund the Civil War as well.
Sounds like a Republican to me, too.
Yeah. Well, Lincoln was a good Republican. You know, the Republican Party was actually started in 1856 in response to corruption of the Democratic Party, which was very real. And it was the party of reform. If you go back and read the platforms of the Republican Party in the 1860s, 1870s, right up through 1874 or 76, I forget which it is, they're really very progressive platforms. And then the party got taken over by, you know, basically bought out by the railroad interests. And so that was the end of that. But I'm not all that ready to just, you know, to use that simple. I mean, it's like the Republicans referring to the Democratic Party as they did for many years as the War Party. Because, you know, Wilson, a Democrat, World War One, Roosevelt, World War II, Truman, the Korean War, LBJ, and Kennedy, the Vietnam War. And, you know, there's some truth to that, that the Democrats got us into a lot of wars. And frankly, I don't think we should have been in World War One, and clearly we shouldn't have been in Vietnam. But does that make the Democrats warmongers? I don't think so.
And then look at the policies that Bush is following. It sounds like Wilsonian to me. I mean, as far as domestically, it's bad.
And not just domestically, but also internationally. Woodrow Wilson basically lied us into World War One. He created public relations in order to do that.
Right,
and that's
right.
and let's be honest about it. The guy was a Democrat. So anyhow, Frank, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
You have a good one.
You too. And good to have you in the chat room, by the way. I know you hang out there. Tony in Washington, D.C., on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
How you doing? Long time no call.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Tony.
I've been listening. I just want to say I did call Mr. Biden's office. I know that he won't hear it personally, and the lady who tried to take the information probably throw it in the trash pile and let them know that start worrying about your job as representative of the progressive movement as Democrats. Like you said, we're not going to sit down and let these people who just bash people who are talking righteously, maybe not say it as formally if they would have said it, but they wouldn't have said it at all.
Right. So you told Joe Biden's call person that Joe should have supported Howard Dean. How did he or she respond?
Thank you. She was very, very complimentary over the telephone manners, and she did not hang up on me or told me, yes, thank you very much, I hang up. She took my information, and she wrote it down, and she stated, and I'm hoping she'll pass it on, and then I'm going to go down the list. I'm going to call Ms. Pelosi and saying that you don't speak up unless somebody speak for you.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Nancy Pelosi has attacked Howard Dean, has she?
Yes.
Oh, she did?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah, so she's also worried about her political job,
corporate
job, put it that way. But like I said, they get close to the corner because the corner is going to get a lot more congested.
More crowded here, yeah. Well said, Tony. Well said. Thanks a lot for the call.
Take care. And
thanks a lot for calling these elected officials and holding them accountable. I salute you. That is the work of our day. The work of our day is to be citizens, to be active in the political process. Polis, the old Greek word of the people, right? To be politically active, to be part of all of this. And I think it's an important thing. The point that Ellen Ratner was making in the reporter, I guess Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, about the great tobacco capitulation. Now, this is pretty mind-boggling. Back in 2001, we're talking 4 years ago, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez was being interviewed by CNN, and they asked him about the tobacco industry. And he said, the White House drives a lot of policy on issues that affect the tobacco industry. And then he went on to say, we want to foster an atmosphere of cooperation. speaking of big tobacco. Okay, so the tobacco industry, I mean, that's like saying, I mean, here you are on national TV, the lawyer for the president, saying we want to foster an atmosphere of cooperation. That's like saying, hey, guys, you got a truck full of cash? Bring it over to the side door here. It's, you know, pretty straightforward. And sure enough, the truck full of cash showed up. $10 million from the tobacco industry suddenly showered on the Republican Party. And so now we see that the Bush administration has reduced by 92% from $130 billion down to $10 billion, the amount of money that the tobacco industry is going to have to pay as part of the settlement in this lawsuit that's been dragging on for all these years. And the tobacco industry lost, and they'd already set aside the money, they budgeted for it, they had the whole, you know, and this was money that was going to then be used to educate our kids not to smoke. The Bush administration said, nah, we don't need to educate our kids not to smoke, and you don't need to pay all that money. Don't worry, you gave us $10 million, we'll give you $120 billion. I mean, that's how it works in Washington, D.C. Politicians for sale cheap. What I find, what boggles my mind, is when you go through these lists of how much politicians are given in exchange for what they do. You know, like Doc Hastings, the guy who's the chairman of the Ethics Committee. Preston Gates, the lobbying firm, to get him to stand up on the floor of the House of Representatives and condemn an effort to have minimum wage law, the U.S. minimum wage law, extended to the Marianas Islands, which the U.S. controls. Where you can manufacture clothing that says made in USA on it, because the U.S. controls it. It's one of these protectorates that's, you know, a remnant of World War II. And therefore, things made there command a premium here, because it says made in USA on it. And right now, the minimum wage there is like $2.50 an hour. And to raise that to $5.15 an hour, to make a decent minimum wage, and to say that it's not appropriate for the people working in the sweatshops there to be in barbed wire enclosures and to be forced into prostitution, because the other major industry on the Marianas Islands is the sex trade. And here you got Doc Hastings standing up on the floor of the House defending this. Defending this practice and saying, oh, these corporations, they should not be forced to pay minimum wage, and we shouldn't tighten the laws against the sexual exploitation of people on the Marianas Islands. And how much money did he get to do this, which makes millions of dollars in profits for the companies that are doing business there? $14,000. I mean, I can't. All over America, there have to be prostitutes looking at these guys going, they don't understand economics. You got to charge more. I mean, you're going to make somebody $100 billion, at least charge them $90 billion. I guess it kind of, it kind of demonstrates that the Republicans are not quite the businessmen they thought they were. You know, they say, oh, yes, we understand business. You give me $10 million, I give you $110 billion. Isn't that reasonable? Somehow, I don't think so. Well, at least now, finally, Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, has said, something should be done about this. Something should be done about this. He just issued a statement. He said, for 6 years, taxpayer dollars have been invested in pursuing the public's case against big tobacco, and yesterday, this would be now the day before yesterday. I discussed this yesterday as well, but it's really worth revisiting. At the 11th hour, it appears that a political order was issued from on high in an attempt to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. The Justice Department put the tobacco company's financial interest ahead of the health interests of hundreds of thousands of Americans hooked on this deadly drug. I would say millions. Millions of Americans. I mean, it's going to kill 400,000 Americans this year. But it's going to harm millions. The facts are clear, convincing, and simple. Big tobacco companies spent decades and billions of dollars misleading the American people in order to hook them on a deadly habit that kills 400,000 Americans each and every year. Today they must face the consequences. He says, I hope that Judge Gladys Kessler, who has spent 5 years reviewing all the evidence of illegal conduct by the tobacco industry, will choose to ignore this political move by the administration and instead recognize the immense harm this industry has inflicted on the public and order damages appropriate with that conduct. The administration needs to explain their sudden change in course. Today I'm calling for an investigation into, says Tom Harkin, and therefore I am calling for an inspector general investigation into possible political interference in this litigation. I mean, this makes Teapot Dome look like, yeah, Teapot Dome was a few million bucks. Albert Fell, you know, in the Harding administration, he leased, he gave it a lease on oil, drilling oil in the naval reserves at Teapot Dome to a friend of his. It was a few million dollars. That was nothing. This is $110 billion. Teapot Dome. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And then, on the flip side of this, so here we have, on the one side, you've got George W. Bush and his Republican cohorts, and you got them coming along going, let's suck up to Big Tobacco. After all, they gave us $10 million. We'll give them $110 billion. At the same time, Congressman David Obie, Democrat from Wisconsin, had a conversation with the folks over at the Veterans Administration. He says, current funding for veterans' health care cannot meet the needs of veterans already in the system, let alone the anticipated influx of those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. He pointed out that from 1995 to 2004, the number of vets treated at VA facilities went from 2.7 to 4.7 million. The medical costs are increasing at double the rate of inflation. The VA facilities are old and crumbling. Improvements are going to cost $1 billion a year over the next 10 years, according to the VA. So he said, okay, let's fund this. And he proposed legislation that would do something. It's very rare to have legislation do this that would be flat funded, that it would pay for itself. In other words, he built into the legislation the mechanism to pay for the expense. He said, if we go back to George Bush's most recent tax cut for millionaires, literally for millionaires, only on people earning over $1 million a year in income, the average tax cut for people making more than $1 million a year in income was $140,000 last year. That was their tax cut. They got an extra $140,000 back. He said, let's just reduce that to $129,000. We'll give them a $129,000 tax cut instead of a $140,000 tax cut for those people who earn over $1 million a year. They're still going to get a tax cut. It's still going to be six figures. We'll just make it $129 instead of $140 million. And if we did that, we would have enough money to fund six specific needs for the Veterans Administration. And he laid them out. He said, if we did that, we could then give $1.5 billion to the Veterans Administration for medical services to meet the increased demand. What the VA is asking for. The Republicans voted it down. They said no. No, can't do that. We can't give $1.5 billion to the Veterans Administration to meet the increased demand as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan, because you're trying to fund it by reducing the tax cut for millionaires from $140,000 a year to $129,000 a year. Can't do it. Sorry. The Republicans voted it down. So then he said, well, how about $500 million for rising medical administrative costs? No, said the Republicans. How about $300 million to keep the VA facilities open and running? No, said the Republicans. Not if you're going to cut into the tax cut for millionaires. How about $67 million for VA research, medical and prosthetic research to develop better hands and arms, artificial hands and arms, for people who had them blown off, and legs and feet in Iraq? No, not if you're going to have to reduce the tax cut for millionaires, said the Republicans. Well, how about, said David Obie, how about $201 million to build medical clinics and long-term care facilities for these vets in parts of the country where they can't get to services? No, said the Republicans. Not if we're going to have to reduce the tax cut to millionaires and billionaires. How about he said, you've got some veterans who are having to wait 6 months to a year to see for their first doctor's appointment. How about just $37 million, what the VA says would be enough to reduce that waiting time down to a month? How about we do that? No, said the Republicans. Not if you're going to fund it by reducing the tax cut on people who earn over $1 million a year from a $140,000 tax cut to a $129,000 tax cut. No. No money for veterans, said the Republicans. Are you starting to notice a trend here? I think so. Oh, my. 10 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Bob in Maine on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank
you. Back to your point on why people are taking such small kickbacks, let's call it.
Yeah.
if they're giving out billions and only taking a few thousand here and there. There's two other things that are happening that I think you forgot about. One is, look at the jobs they get when they leave the government. And the second one is...
Enlightened self-interest.
Yeah.
Superseding institutional interest.
Under-the-table cash at the restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one you'll never trace, but you can't tell me that boat payments and house payments and other things aren't being made that way because...
Well, I think in this day and age, they do it a little more subtly. I mean, you look at Tom DeLay, for example. This is a guy who owned a failed insecticide company.
Right.
And then went into public service.
Right.
And is now a millionaire.
But, yep.
But wasn't before. And I think last I looked, the salary for a member of the House of Representatives was around $130,000 a year. So, you know, how did he get to be a millionaire?
You got a good point there.
Yeah, well, you know, and the way I'm sure it was the same thing. You know, it was George W. Bush, the son of the vice president. He pays $600,000 for his share in the Texas Rangers stock, and he sells it for $14 million.
Mm.
I mean, you know, it's a good investment, right?
Right, right.
Just a good investment.
And it's a lot safer than cash under the table.
Yeah, there you go. So I think that's how these things happen. Bob, thanks a lot for the call.
Hey,
good to hear from
you. Tom.
I appreciate
Bye.
It. Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom, your last guest gave me a really, really good idea for the neocons now.
What's that?
The Republican Davidians.
The Republican Davidians?
You like that?
Yes.
So we should just call them the Republican Davidians. Neocons is too passe.
Well, and that reminds me, what is the link between an elephant named Ganesh and the KKK and the Family Research Council and Tony Perkins? I will be revealing that in the next hour of the program. So.
Oh, boy, okay, I'll be listening.
we will be getting into that.
I got one more little suggestion here. Tell me what you think about this. Now that CD burners and DVD burners and DVDs and CDs themselves are pretty cheap, I was thinking about maybe getting a whole bunch of sound bites and a whole bunch of scanned newspaper articles, putting them on CDs and DVDs, and to start handing them out by the masses.
Hey, that's a plan. That's the, you know, pamphleteering in the new era. That's a great idea, Sean. Hey, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you in Indianapolis. I appreciate it. Hey, there's an idea. Why hand out paper when you can hand out discs? That's how AOL built their empire. CompuServe was, you know, owned the internet, and AOL came along and just started giving away all. Remember, people used them as coasters. The floppy disks originally. Freebies. What an idea. Interesting.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncover uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman with you. Drop into our chat room, our live chat room, if you'd like. TomHartman.com. Click live chat. Folks discussing how to get together enough audio for Sean to start passing out. I think it's a great idea. What can I say? Remarkable doings over at the Family Research Council. The Family Research Council, of course, its executive director, Tony Perkins, reportedly paid former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke over $80,000 back in 1996. Now, what did he give him for that? What did he get for that? Well, he got his mailing list. Interesting. KKK Grand Wizard's mailing list is of interest to the Family Research Council. This from The Nation magazine. 4 years ago, Perkins addressed the Louisiana chapter of the Council of Conservative Christians, the CCC, America's premier white supremacist organization, the successor to the White Citizens' Councils, which battled integration in the South. In 1996, Perkins paid former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke $82,500 for his mailing list. At the time, Perkins was the campaign manager for a right-wing Republican candidate from the U.S. Senate in Louisiana. The Federal Election Commission fined the campaign Perkins ran $3,000 for attempting to hide the money that Tony Perkins paid to David Duke. But wait, there's more! Now Tony Perkins is suggesting that it's appropriate to starve people in Africa if it sends a message to churches that homosexuality is not to be accepted. The question, of course, that AmericaBlog.com asks, who would Jesus starve, Tony? This from the Reverend Moon-owned Washington Times. Anglican bishops in Africa who are refusing millions of dollars from liberal American Episcopal sources to protest homosexual clergy say the price of their protest has been higher than they thought. The Rwandan Bishop John Runcia of the Diocese of Sharia says, to be honest, there's not enough money for the needs that we have in Rwanda after the genocide of 1994, but if money is being used to disgrace the gospel, then we don't need it. The Reverend Allison Barfoot, assistant to the Anglican Archbishop of Uganda, said the Anglican province has no working phones in its Kampala headquarters because it lacks the funds. Conservative American churches haven't pitched in enough. Definitely not to the extent of what we've given up, she said. The conservative American churches, of course, being the ones who encouraged them not to take money from those awful Anglicans who had the temerity to install a gay man as a bishop in New Hampshire. Although the church in Uganda accepted $30,000 from Trinity Episcopal in February for a women's credit program, it turned down assistance from the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan for school fees for 60 girls. And last month, the Ugandan province rejected a $27,000 donation from the New Hampshire Diocese to improve local schools. Central Pennsylvania Bishop Michael F. Crichton called Bishop Nazarizibi's decision a Good Friday nail on the compassion of Christ. But David Duke's enabler, Tony Perkins, praised this. This is the Family Research Council, the folks that Bill Frist spoke about. Remember Justice Sunday? Bill Frist speaking before this group. In the last hour, we were talking about what causes people to follow folks like David Koresh and Jones, crazy Mr. Jones down there. Anglican bishops in Africa are refusing millions of dollars from American Episcopal Church donors, said Tony Perkins. David Duke's, the guy who bought the mailing list from David Duke's, the Family Research Council president, He said, Anglican bishops in Africa are refusing millions of dollars from American Episcopal Church donors who have endorsed active homosexual clergy following the 2003 election of openly homosexual New Hampshire Bishop V. Gene Robinson. Refusing, now I'm quoting Tony Perkins here, refusing these pieces of silver from liberal American sources has put an especially heavy burden on the Rwandan diocese, still trying to recuperate from the after effects of the 1994 genocide in that country. However, said Tony Perkins, as Rwandan Bishop John Runsehana of the Diocese of Sharia put it, if money is being used to disgrace the gospel, then we don't need it. Tony Perkins added, I applaud the actions of the African Anglican churches. No amount of silver is worth sacrificing your duty to your congregation and to God. Yes, just let them starve. Is that what... I'm sorry. That's not what the Jesus that I know would do. But wait, there's more. It gets even stranger. Robert H. Knight, director of the Culture and Family Institute, an affiliate of the Concerned Women of America. This is another one of these groups out there that are working on this anti-gay agenda. Another one of the so-called Christian groups. Comes out and says that the reason why San Francisco has a low under 18 population compared with the rest of the United States is because of gays. It's because there's gays in San Francisco, he says. He goes on to say the homosexual lifestyle is about pleasing oneself, not planning for the future, not setting aside money for kids, not trying to create a set, blah, blah, blah. I'm speechless. You know, I lived in San Francisco for a summer back in the 80s. I can tell you, it's like a peninsula. There's no more land. The reason why there are not a lot of children in San Francisco is because a family of childbearing age can't afford an apartment in San Francisco. It's got nothing to do with gays. It's got to do with yuppies if you want to go after somebody. It's got to do with skyrocketing household prices. I mean, that's the bottom line. But they quote reliable news from a Christian source. It's all about and then they go on to say it's a bad thing. Now, let me just add as a bit of a digression here, but nonetheless, let me just add there is a lot of hysteria coming out of the right. And I've been surprised by how much of it I have heard on mainstream or at least cable network news, you know, on Chris Matthews or, you know, that kind, those kinds of things. A lot of hysteria and concern about the fact that in several European countries, the populations are actually declining. And there seem to be two folks who are really concerned about this, or two groups of folks who are really concerned about this. One are the racists who are concerned about the fact that Caucasians' birth rates are declining in many parts of the world, and they really don't want that happening because those brown people are having babies, they're saying. And this flips them out, the racists, the paranoid racists. And you find that a lot of the conversation that they're having about how abortion should be made illegal and how birth control should be made illegal is really ultimately, when you get right down to it, about that they want to see Caucasians, they want to see white people having more babies. So there's that bunch. And some of them cloak it in religion and some of them cloak it in culture and some of them, but it's at its core, it's racism. And then there's those folks who talk about it in terms of economics, like we need more consumers. And when a nation's population starts going negative, then you're going to have more people retiring, you're going to have fewer people being productive, and that's a crisis. And they point to, for example, the demographics of the United States right now, the baby boom generation retiring. So let's look at history for just a minute. The Black Death hit Europe in 1345, more or less, 1350s, and lasted more or less, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. It was a terribly fatal thing. More than half of the people in many, many of the countries of Europe were wiped out by the Black Plague. And the result of this, the result, well, this from learner.org, an interesting site on the Renaissance. The population decrease caused by the plague initially led to an economic depression. Merchants and tradespeople had fewer people with whom they could sell their wares. Products therefore accumulated. Merchants and traders suffered a loss in income. Economic hardship spread through the community, as those who dealt with the merchants, bankers, suppliers, shippers lost revenue, of course, over the short term. However, as the incidence of the plague decreased in the late 15th century, there was now a new demand for goods and services. A new middle class began to emerge. Now, why? Because now you have a situation where, well, here, you've got fewer people and the same number of resources. And what did this lead to? It led to the Renaissance. As the fortunes of merchants, bankers, and tradespeople improved, they had more than enough money to meet their basic needs for food, clothing, and shelter. They began to desire larger, more luxurious homes, fine art for these residences, sumptuous clothing to show off their wealth. The desires of the middle class stimulated the economy. The middle class population also had leisure time to spend on education. In fact, education was essential for many middle class professions. What had happened was that you had workers. Workers were in such short supply after the Black Plague that they were able to form into unions. It was the beginning of the guilds. They were able to say to the business people, you know, we're not going to work for those wages. And you can't find anybody else to. They're all dead. And the result was that Europe shifted from a feudal society, from 1,000 years of being a feudal society, into the Renaissance. A middle class began to emerge because there were fewer people and the same amount of resources. A middle class began to, I don't think anybody wants to say the Black Plague was a great blessing, but the reduction in population was a great blessing. It brought about the Renaissance. And if that reduction in population, instead of being done by plague, is done by people deciding to have one or two children instead of five or six, then might not that be a good thing for society, particularly with 6 billion people on the planet, where half of the people on Earth, you know, 3 billion people are living on roughly $2 a day. And now we've got the cons coming along saying, and we need to level the playing field. You, the American worker, need to compete with all those people in the open marketplace. Those people who are living on $2 a day and are willing to work for 20 cents an hour. I don't think so. You know, number one, I don't think that that's wise economics. And number two, exploding the population even greater doesn't make any sense. So, pardon the digression. There's more on the religious part here. We'll get back to that. And what does Ganesh have to do with it? Right after this, 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You can get it if you really want.
You just have to get politically active. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The newest battle in the culture wars. Notes ABC News, Jake Tapper and Jeffrey Bennett. The newest battle in the culture wars is being waged on the telephone lines. In a departure from the standard telemarketing calls aimed at selling long-distance service, United American Technology has taken telemarketing to a whole new level. The Oklahoma-based long-distance carrier, which describes itself as a Christian conservative company, is seeking like-minded customers by bad-mouthing bigger rivals for their sinful behavior. Our base, which would be a conservative base, UAT consultant Carl Thompson told ABC News, really does not like the same-sex marriage that has been pushed down our throat. UAT niche markets its service by railing against internet pornography, homosexuality, and then criticizing competing phone companies that it claims promote both. And so they got this guy on. Some say UAT takes its politics too far. New York City comedian Eugene Mirman was so astonished by a UAT call that he received, he recorded it. Mirman believes he was contacted because he donated $51 to the 1996 presidential campaign of Republican Alan Keyes. And he did that, he says, as something of a joke. Same way I gave $5 to the Republican National Committee last year. You'll find my name on their donor list. Why? I want to get their literature. I want to get their emails. I want to, you know, I wanted to, and I get them, and I get the talking points from the Republicans every day, and, you know, it's just interesting stuff. I mean, this is the business I'm in. So this guy had given some money to Alan Keyes, probably, presumably for the same reason. So anyhow, Mirman says, I got a phone call. It was a recording, and it said, "Hi, I'm the mother of three, and I don't support gay marriage. If you don't support gay marriage, press 1. He says, I have something hooked up to the phone to record phone calls, and so I scrambled around and found it. And every time they'd call, I'd record it because it was crazy. And then here's the transcript of this. A UAT telemarketer. Okay, Eugene, did you press 1 to oppose same-sex marriages? Yeah, I pressed it, yes. Oh, that's great to hear. Now, are you against same-sex marriage? Well, yes, I want to destroy it. Oh, that's great to hear. And Eugene, with a fist of God, we will smash them. Exactly. Mr. Mirman, our organization is dedicated to people such as yourself who want to stop same-sex marriages and quit doing business with companies that promote and profit from the homosexual lifestyle.
Some companies profit from homosexuality?
That's correct.
By selling sex favors?
No, such as AT&T, what they do.
AT&T sells sex favors?
No. What they own, the Hot Network, which is a hardcore pornography channel, and they give millions of dollars to the Gay and Lesbian Alliance group.
And it, you know, it goes on. I mean, this is Mirman, so what are the others? What does Verizon do?
Oh, Verizon, they train their employees to accept a gay and lesbian lifestyle.
They try to turn their employees gay?
No. They train their employees to accept it.
Mirman, he goes, I think all pornography is hardcore. It's wrong. AT&T sponsored porn. No,
that's MCI.
MCI sponsors hardcore child pornography.
Yes, they have a pedophile website for men who love boys. It's a Montreal.
Oh, my God, the Canadian perverts.
Yes.
So MCI basically has a child pornography.
Yes, that's correct.
This to sell telephone service. Long-distance telephone service. So basically, Mirman says, this is all a recorded conversation with an actual salesperson for this phone company. So basically, God hates AT&T, MCI, and Verizon. Pause.
Yes, sir. And Mr. Mirman, do you make a lot of long-distance calls or just a few every month?
You get it. It is. I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. It is the selling of God, the exploitation of God, in my mind... Speaking as somebody who actually takes this stuff seriously, I think this is sacrilegious. I think it's absolutely sacrilegious. Speaking of sacrilegious, there are some folks in Tulsa who are very concerned about the elephant. Yes, the elephant in the Tulsa Zoo. The elephant, believe it or not, the elephant in the Tulsa Zoo has found itself embroiled in a religious controversy with fundamentalists. More on that after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. You going to take the blue one or the red one? Your choice.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Take a straight and stronger course to the corner of your life. Make the white queen run so fast, she hasn't got time to make you wise.
Welcome back, Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You are in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. TomHartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. If you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message area in the blog. Okay, the Tulsa Zoo. Here's the story. As incredible as it may seem, at the Tulsa Zoo there is an elephant. Or maybe more than one. And in the elephant, elephants. And in the region where the area where the elephants are kept, the elephant display, whatever you call that, a zoo, the elephant, yeah, exhibit. Exhibits are what they call them in zoos. At the elephant exhibit, they have a statue of an elephant, and under it a sign that says simply that its name is Ganesh, G-A-N-E-S-H. Now, the curator of the exhibit at the Tulsa Zoo says that he's not promoting Hinduism. He's simply pointing out that the elephants in India are considered gods. Which, you know, by the way, is true. You know, the elephants are, and Ganesh is the name of the Indian elephant god. Not that elephants are considered gods in India. Let me rephrase that. In Hinduism, in classic Hinduism, there is a deity way back, you know, there in the early days, that was mostly elephant, Ganesh. And so Brett Fiddler, Fiddler of the zoo, says, we exhibit it out of the religious context, strictly as a museum piece. But Dan Hicks and John Jones, a couple of local folks who are offended by this, want their religion included. Now, I'm not sure how they do this. I suppose, you know, the early Christians used the fish as a sign of their religion, as a way of, you know, hey, I know you, you know me, we're part of the same club. And this came out of the fact that the time that Jesus showed up around 2,000 years ago was more or less the dawning of the age of Pisces. And later on, you know, the mythology got changed to it was about the fisherman, but the fisherman wasn't Jesus, it was Peter. But in any case, the fish has come to be associated with Christianity because it was the hot religious icon of that day. And so maybe what Hicks and Jones want is for there to be a fish god over on the fish display. I don't get it. And then they're also concerned that at the entrance to the zoo, there's a globe, a planet Earth. And it says, the Earth is our mother, the sky is our father. And the zoo staff said they put it there to add a Native American flair. And Hicks says, it's another example of openness to anything except Christianity. That, you know, maybe there should be a crucifix or something over there instead. And so the Tulsa Zoo is getting hassled, and this is actually turning into, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, turning into a big deal. It's turning into a real big deal. People, they're asking people to call the mayor's office, and we're just confirming this right now. Kareth is calling the mayor's office in Tulsa to find out, are you getting phone calls from people about this Ganesh elephant god thing in the zoo? And, you know, if so, we'll pass out the phone number. Sometimes these things, I mean, we've got to fact check this stuff because sometimes it's just too weird to be true. But here from the Democratic Underground, Democratic Underground link, I just got off the phone with the exhibits curator at the Tulsa Zoo. She had called me back after I'd emailed her asking what's going to happen to the Tulsa Parks Commission because they bowed to some fundy person to put up a creationist viewpoint exhibit. Ah, now we get to the real agenda here. They want there to be a creationist exhibit at the zoo, and they're using Ganesh, the elephant god, as the excuse for it. Interesting. Anyhow, she said that what we need to do is flood the mayor's office and the Parks Commission with emails and phone calls about this. This is pretty much a one-sided argument due to the AM radio stations, fundamentalist churches, and Mayor Bill LaFortune, or LaFortune, blindsiding everyone. The mayor told the zoo staff not to show up at a meeting last night that discussed the proposed creationism exhibit. So, very interesting stuff. Very, very interesting stuff. Kareth, can you tell us what you learned?
Well, I just called the mayor's office in Tulsa, and it sounds like they're getting quite a few calls. They got quite a few yesterday as well.
Interesting. And so this is really going on.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
All righty. Well, I'll put that number out. Thank you, Kareth, for checking that out. I'll put that phone number out. It is area code 918-596-7411. That is area code 918-596-7411. And Kareth will post that in the chat room also, a post from our show engineer, if you'd like to call the Tulsa mayor's office and say what? You're using a statue of an elephant as an excuse to put in an exhibit on creationism? Now, in the meantime, here we find in another Midwestern state, Ohio, has spent $455,000 now in taxpayer money to teach abstinence until marriage only sex ed to students in middle school and high school. In other words, they're teaching sex education, but they're not quite teaching sex education because the only thing they're teaching about sex in the sex education course is don't do it until you're married. And they decided to, Dr. Scott Frank, a leading public health researcher at Case Western Reserve University, decided to check out exactly what the kids were learning. And this, keep in mind, this is a report from this week. And I know, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, there was some discussion about this in the media that, you know, in some strange place, they were teaching this stuff. The Bush administration was putting out literature on this. And the word that we got was, it's all been taken care of. Don't worry. You know, we're not teaching this stuff anymore. Here's what was taught to Ohio teens with $500,000 of taxpayer money. Number one, AIDS and HIV can be transmitted through tears and open mouth kissing. Number two, no known cases of that. Number two, contraceptives are to blame for mental health problems in teens. Number three, taking the pill will increase a girl's future chances of infertility. And number four, students should just, quote, from the school curriculum, quote, follow God's plan for purity, end quote. And, you know, what they're finding is, of course, the unfortunate result is that you're just seeing an increase in teen pregnancies. Because the reality is that families are always going to have more impact on kids, and the larger culture is going to have more impact on kids than anything you teach them in school. And so there it goes. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, the Tulsa mayor's office, 918-596-7411, but our number, 1-866-889-8894. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, on the line. Hey Roy, what's up?
Tom, actually, I thought I'd call and kind of fill in what they're doing here in New Mexico.
Okay, what's your fine state up to?
Our governor, who is a fine middle of the road liberal Republican, although he calls himself a Democrat,
Mr. Richardson.
Bill Richardson.
Yep.
The state just bought a $5.5 million jet. Of course, the old one was 20 years old and all kinds of been grounded a bunch of times for safety things. Well, the Republicans are doing the slime boat liars attack ads, and they're running it on all the radio stations here in the state, or not all, darn sure not Clear Channel, and not, I don't know if they're doing 1490 out of Los Alamos or not, but anyway, run it on the big boomer right-wing stations, and they went in and ran it up in New Hampshire because Richardson was up there yesterday. And they set it up with a lifestyles of the rich and famous, who's got a $5.5 million jet, who's got chefs on his staff and whatnot. Well, it's not, you know, it's your governor. And he's
well, every governor in the United States who has a governor's mansion has a cook. And, you know, I mean,
somebody got a cook for all. And he's raising taxes and he's doing this and he's doing that.
Yeah.
And it is just. I don't know who designed it, but it had to have been the same production company that did the Slime Boat Liars ads.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're doing it to kind of neutralize Richardson. And, of course, his spokesmen are, well, they're just picking on us, and everybody's got to, you know. But, again, it's like
it's just out there. It's, you know, it's already setting up the campaign.
Yeah, this is the old Lee Atwater, Chuck Colson thing.
Oh, it just cut him off at the knees.
Yeah, absolutely. Back in the Nixon campaign, and what was it, the 72 campaign, as I recall, or 74? I mix up those years. 72 campaign. They determined that Ed Muskie was a candidate who could beat Richard Nixon in the general election. And that, who was the guy who ran against Nixon in 72, ultimately? It was
McGovern.
Yeah, George McGovern.
Yeah,
I believe it was. Yeah, George McGovern. That McGovern couldn't. And so they went out to take out Ed Muskie in the primaries. And Chuck Colson and another guy whose name I've long since forgotten went up to New Hampshire. And the story is, they acknowledge, Colson acknowledges that they stole some of Muskie's letterhead and sent this letter off to the local newspaper using the word Canuck, which is a derogatory term for French ancestry Americans, which are heavily, a lot of New Hampshire folks are French Canadian, origin. And they sent out this phony letter, and the Manchester Union Leader, the right-wing newspaper, did a whole attack thing on their front page editorials when William Loeb was the publisher, when he was still alive, of that thing, and went after Muskie. And Muskie gets up on this flatbed truck and starts talking about this, and starts wandering off into talking about his wife, and starts crying. And it was the end of Muskie's career, and the folklore around the story is, and which has never been either refuted or, to the best of my knowledge, absolutely confirmed, but there are a number of people who suggest, was that not only did they set this thing up, but they also put LSD in Muskie's coffee. And so he's standing up there tripping. But in any case, the point was that they used incredible dirty tricks to take out Muskie. Then you had Bush, George Bush Jr., George W. Bush, who was, in the primaries, that John McCain could take him out. So down in South Carolina, in the South Carolina primary, this was the pivotal one to see who's going to win. Karl Rove goes in there, and they do these push polls where they called 10,000-20,000 people, and they call them up, and they say, hi, we're doing a poll. We're an unaffiliated, non-blah-de-blah-de-blah. How would it change your vote if you learned that John McCain had been treated multiple times for mental illness as a consequence of his having gone insane from being a prisoner of war in solitary confinement 5 years in Vietnam? How would it change your vote if you learned that John McCain's wife was currently under the treatment of a psychiatrist and taking psychiatric drugs? How would it change your vote if you learned that John McCain has had a child out of wedlock with an African-American woman? And, they never said that any of these things were true, and none of them were true, by the way. The McCains had adopted a child from Bangladesh who has a relatively dark skin. And so, people might, who knows what kind of mythology that this push poll would then generate, right? And that push poll was what made the difference. That's why George Bush was the guy who was running for president in 2000 rather than John McCain on the Republican side, was because of that push poll. And then in Iowa, I believe to this day, and I will always believe, that Howard Dean, if he had been the Democratic Party's nominee, would have kicked George Bush's butt in the polls.
That's why they spent so much money to defeat him.
I know, and that's my point. The only candidate that the Republicans spent money to defeat in the Democratic primaries in the year 2004 was Howard Dean. They went into Iowa and they spent $1 million on those ads about, let's send that latte-drinking, Volvo-driving liberal back to Vermont where he came from. And they took him out. The Republicans took him out. And thus we had John Kerry, who, in my opinion, still beat George Bush, but that's a whole other discussion. This is what you're describing, is the pre-positioning stuff, and the Republicans are brilliant at it, and the Democrats are clueless.
Two other quick points about it.
Yeah.
Every station yesterday afternoon talked about these ads that were going to be run, and every one of them ran. Well, here's this ad. Let us play it for you.
Yeah.
And then they would talk about it and talk about it.
A little pre-publicity.
And now that gave them, the local Rush wannabes their hook for today's story of, gee, they're whining about these ads, and these are all official, and they're all work, and whatever. And so they're getting multiple benefit from the money that they're spending.
Yeah. I personally don't
view Richardson as a viable national candidate. However, he'll have to run for re-election for the governor 2 years from now also. And so I don't know if they're just going after him as a setup to nail him.
They're doing this, you know, they're doing the same thing with
around the country.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. And they're doing the same thing right now with Hillary Clinton. They're rolling out a book that has already been discredited. It's another this one has got Richard Mellon Scaife behind it. And, you know, surprise.
And then again, the focusing on Dean with, and you know, again,
yep.
All of it is how whacked out Dean is when all he's doing is telling the truth.
There you go. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, this is it's over the top. I mean, it is over the top what these cons are up to and that the American people are buying it and that the press is buying into it. So much for the liberal media, right? 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. GM stock rises yesterday. This is the result of GM's announced decision to lay off 25,000 workers. And Kerkorian... good old Kirk Kerkorian, made out like a bandit. Wednesday was a good day for General Motors Corp and billionaire corporate raider Kirk Kerkorian. Shares of GM posted their biggest gain in a month. The same day, the Las Vegas casino mogul announced he soon will own a 7.2% stake in the automaker, and a day after GM announced the first step in a highly anticipated restructuring. We are seeing now, you know, folks are saying, well, this is the fault of the employees. They're paid too much. Yeah. Well, and there are some folks who are saying, and correctly so, this is the fault of management who failed to anticipate what should have been obvious, and that is that that oil prices are going to go up over time and demand for SUVs is going to go down, particularly in a trickle-down economy under voodoo economics, under Bushonomics. You're going to see the destruction of the middle class and thus its ability to buy things like gasoline. And we've been through this before. We went through this with Nixon. I mean, we went through this in the 70s. And GM failed to anticipate it then, too. In fact, it was a crisis, such a terrible crisis for Chrysler. And then at the same time, I get an email from Philip. He says, I work for a small three-man shop in Medford, Mass. My boss, Ray, started the business 20 years ago out of his mother's basement, and since then has provided dozens of good-paying jobs to folks like me, all the while usually paying himself less than his employees. He says, and the right-wingers would have us believe that only the rich create jobs. As I've said many times, that's not true. Most jobs are created by fairly middle-class folks who are entrepreneurs. But in any case, he says, this morning he let us know that our health insurance, already so expensive for the business that it's almost impossible to provide, is going up again. The cost is going up $300 a year for me and my coworker Joe. More money comes out of our paychecks. And he says, you know, what can I do about this? He says, I'm so angry about this healthcare system. I heard you saying from other sources that every single person in this country could be covered if insurance companies got their grubby fingers out of the equation. Yes, if you just took out the profits that are, you know, of every $100 that goes through Medicare, $2 to $3 sticks to the finger of administration. That's what it costs to administer Medicare, single-payer healthcare system. But for every $100 that goes through our private health insurance companies, anywhere from $15 to $35 sticks to their fingers, depending on the company. And if you simply took them out of the equation, the exact same amount of money, you could cover everybody. So I suggested you go to PNHP, physiciansfornationalhealthprogram.org. Check it out. It's a great group of doctors who are working on national health care and a great organization, PNHP, as in Physicians for National Health Program. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.